Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock and Roll podcast, where we explore the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital money. Everyone is talking about the Genius Act these days, the new stablecoin regulation in the US, and we want to do the same. But we won't stop there today because we thought we need to add something to the current discussion. And this is why I invited the perfect guest to the show today to talk not only about Genius, but about the differences between the Genius Act and MiCA, the Markets in Crypto Assets Regulation, and what those differences mean for Europe, for the EU, for European stablecoin issuers, but also for the ECB, for regulators. And to this end, I'm very happy to welcome Anja von Rosenstiel, who is without doubt the perfect guest for this topic, because Anja is not only a licensed lawyer in Germany, but also in the US. She works as a counsel at FinLaw in Frankfurt and is also an adjunct professor at Boston University in Boston, Massachusetts. Anja, thanks a lot for being here. It's great to have you on.
Thank you very much for having me. And I have to admit, I'm a regular listener to your podcast to know what's going on in Europe. And I'm very excited to be here on the other side for once. So thank you.
That's perfect. Anja and I have written an article together for Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, which is one of Germany's biggest newspapers. We will, of course, put the link to this article in the show notes, including an English translation, of course. I find it always very difficult to write articles about regulatory things, in particular when it's so timely and things are still moving. So I was very happy, Anja, that I had you on board for that article. And one of your role, Anja, today will for sure be to interrupt me whenever I'm using the wrong legal or regulatory terms to describe things. So you have the permission to interrupt at any point. But first, maybe you want to add a couple of sentences about yourself, to what extent you have been following the developments around the Genius Act and whatever else you want to add to give some color.
Yeah, I mean, you already gave everyone my biography. There's not much to add, perhaps that I'm also a research fellow at the Decentralization Research Center, which at its core advocates for innovation for decentralized blockchain systems. And I'm also a so-called root node in a DAO, where I gain practical experience in DAO governance. And I used to be an advisor in the D-Euro project, which is a decentralized euro underlying project in Switzerland before the Genius Act came into being. Yeah, that I might want to add. And otherwise, I'm happy to start right away.
Okay, then let's jump right in. I mean, let's maybe reflect on that week, you have to say. I mean, it has even been called Crypto Week, and it was not only the Genius Act in the end. I think it was the week 14th to 18th of July. Maybe you can quickly summarize what happened in that week and why everyone has started calling it the Crypto Week in the US.
Yes. So I would like to start with the Genius Act and name it for once. Actually, it is an acronym and it's standing for Guiding and Establishing National Innovation for Stablecoins. And I take the word guiding. So the Genius Act was basically the lowest hanging fruit and was basically most advanced and also the most popular or the most successful use case of crypto. And so the Congress, Senate and Republicans thought they start with this bill, and basically the Genius Act is like a catalyst for everything else that follows. But the Genius Act was signed into law by President Trump on Thursday, but that was not all. There was also the Clarity Act and the Anti-Surveillance CBDC Act. And one could see that the strategy worked out, that first Genius basically was voted on, and we had an amazing bilateral support, which was surprising to everyone. So 308 against 122 members of the House of Representatives voted for it. And then the Clarity Act, again, big surprise, 294 against 134. And Anti-Surveillance Act was kind of split which was also interesting, 219 against 210. But so this catalytic function of the Genius Act really worked. And in this really highly polarized political world in Washington, this is kind of surprising that we have this bipartisan crypto coalition now in Congress and that these laws actually passed, and also Democrats who struggled in supporting these laws in between because of the conflict of interest issues around members of the administration and most of all President Trump's involvement into crypto, basically voted for it because they wanted rules for the market, basically thinking about the users of this technology. They thought about national security, and we are probably going to talk about foreign issues. That is, it's preferable to actually have the biggest stablecoin issuers under your jurisdiction.
Yeah, so we're definitely gonna get to that, Anya. Maybe just quickly to summarize, right? We had three things going on. So we had the Genius Act, we had the Clarity Act. Genius was voted on and passed in the House, right? The Senate had already voted on it. And then I think it was on Friday that Trump then signed it. So that's kind of done. And then we had the Clarity, which was at least passed by the House, but still has to go to the Senate, right? And then this Anti-Surveillance Act was related to, or is related to, CBDCs, which has also passed the House, but still has to go to the Senate. So I would say two acts still ongoing, some debate to be had, but Genius is done. This is now getting into law. And so this is why we in particular want to focus on the Genius Act today.
One caveat. So the Clarity Act will actually contain amendments of the Genius Act. So there will be changes to the Genius Act again, but yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's, of course, now for us in Europe, very interesting, since we have that markets in crypto assets regulation already for some time now. And of course, it's interesting now to compare those two and think a bit about what does it mean for European players in particular, where differences, where similarities. And let's maybe start with the similarities. What I also realized from our discussions over the last days, even if you think things are similar, that in the end, when you go into the details, there are still always small differences. But maybe we start with those things that are almost the same between Genius and Mika.
Yeah. So I would love to do it, but first perhaps say what is actually covered in the Genius Act versus what is covered in MiCA, so that we can compare then. So the Genius Act covers basically the issuer oversight of payment stablecoins. That is basically, I don't have to define payment stablecoins, but they are defined in the Genius Act, and then basically preserving the dual banking system of the US, that you basically have a preservation of the state oversight of banking. And finally, and that is important with regard to MiCA, that secondary market transactions are not at all regulated in Genius. And so that's a very big difference in terms of MiCA and Genius. That is all done in the Clarity Act. But let's start with the similarities. Perhaps,
so you could say that MiCA is broader than Genius, right? We have in MiCA, we also have the service providers that are regulated, which is not at all part of Genius, to my understanding, right?
Yeah. So basically, overall, in terms of a comprehensive framework legislation for market structure, MiCA compares more to the Clarity Act, and basically Genius compares to the section on asset reference tokens and e-money tokens, and that's about it, right?
Okay, similarities.
Yeah, so similarities is basically, I said, regulating the issuer oversight. So who is issuing stablecoins? That's pretty similar to e-money token under MiCA, that you have in, under MiCA, you have real banks, I say, that are defined as CRR, financial institutions who are allowed to lend and engage in classical banking activities and are backed by the central bank. And then you have in Europe the e-money institutions, which are basically fintechs who offer payment services. And it's pretty similar in the sense that you have in the US, comparable to CRR, you have the insured depository institutions, which actually are under the umbrella of the Federal Insurance Depository Corporation. And then you have so-called trust companies that are basically state-regulated institutions who may offer custody services, but they cannot engage in classical banking activities. And that are basically the two who may issue. And that's pretty similar. What is kind of different is that you have also like a provision on big tech, which I can't find under MiCA. So basically that is interesting because MiCA was triggered by the kind of Libra project where Meta was contemplating or was already starting to think about issuing their own stablecoin, an asset reference token. And here you have kind of a Libra clause in the sense that if you are not engaged in any financial activities, services, and are a publicly traded company, you are prohibited to issue stablecoins unless you get a permission by the stablecoin review committee, which is composed of the Treasury Department, who chairs it, the Federal Reserve Board, and the Federal Depository Insurance Company, and they have to come to an anonymous vote, which makes it rather difficult to jump through this loop.
Okay, so we have, I mean, there you already see, of course, since we have that e-money directive in Europe, we have e-money issuers for many years in Europe. This kind of existing piece of regulation was used and also kind of connected to MiCA. That, of course, does not exist in the US, so we have a different approach here. But I think also the most interesting difference is that in under Genius, you have that possibility as a non-bank, let's say, or even non-financial institutionals, at least theoretically, to issue stablecoins. But then you say in particular for the big techs, that's going to be extremely, extremely difficult. I mean, we have heard news about Amazon, for instance, announcing that they want to issue a stablecoin. Also Walmart. Would it be then easier for Walmart to do it than for Amazon, or would they both have the same issues?
No, I think they would run in the same problem because you also have the principle of separation of commerce and banking traditionally. Mm-hmm. And that was actually an amendment that was introduced by the Democratic Party originally, but now basically in the sense of diversification and level playing field, it got bipartisan support. And I think in the Clarity Act in Section 512, it will actually be even stricter, because the Clarity will act when it passes the Senate, will actually add to this Libra clause that they are prohibited from retaining any control of a non-bank entity issuer. So basically, they can use stablecoins. They can basically on a secondary market use stablecoins, but I think they are pretty much out when it comes to the issuance.
Okay. So are there any non-banks then in the US where you would say they have a realistic chance to issue stablecoins?
Well, as a lawyer, if I turn it around, we are talking about publicly traded companies. If you have a closely held company, and if I name certain companies, I don't want to imply anything. It's just to give an example to illustrate the point. So if you have, for example, X or True Social, which are closely held, this clause does not apply. And they can, of course, then in a state go and apply for a state license and then try to apply for an OCC license, a federal license.
I would say that's at least an interesting fact that you have these publicly listed companies that have close to no chance to issue, become a stablecoin issuer, and then you have the non-listed companies that seem to have a chance. And then when you just named a couple of them, and of course that it's X and Truth Social that are two examples. I mean, at least to me, I'm not a lawyer, but for me it's hard to understand the reasoning behind that difference between excluding listed companies and including the non-listed ones.
Let's say we probably will focus on competition later, you know, and a level playing field. And if I take a look at it from a competition perspective, it doesn't really make sense, but it is in there. And yeah, this is how the sausage was made.
Yeah. So something else that's maybe we can be quick on that one, but you correct me if I'm wrong. Interest, when it's about interest, it seems like neither Mika nor Genius allow interest payments from the issuer to anyone who holds or uses the stablecoin. Is there any difference between these interest rate payment prohibitions?
No, so you have a general prohibition that is the same. Let's say the wording is a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And there's already much talk in Washington how easy it is to get around it. First of all, it is, and that's the same as Mika, that, well, let's say not quite the same, but in the US it is linked to the issuer, whereas you, I think in Mika you have, I can look at the wording, but you have like a prohibition of yield-bearing stablecoins as mm-hmm. such, not by the issuer. And then the yield is defined as basically revenue derived solely from holding stablecoins, which is, again, something you can basically get around pretty easily. So what everyone expects is in a situation, and again, I don't want to imply anything, but if I name Circle and Coinbase, Circle cannot issue a yield-bearing stablecoin, but closely works with Coinbase, and Coinbase, of course, can establish a rewards program for the stablecoin distribution channel.
So what you're saying is basically, if someone wanted to circumvent these interest rate prohibitions, it would most likely be easier to do that under Genius versus Mika, because in Mika it's very strong and very broad prohibition.
Yes.
Okay. Something that's extremely important for a stablecoin is, of course, the reserve, since this is backing everything and makes sure that you can always redeem the stablecoin one-to-one for account-based euros or US dollars. So we don't have to go through the long list of assets that are eligible for Mika and Genius, but maybe you can give us a bit of a feeling of whether it's the same, whether there are differences when it comes to how does the reserve have to be composed.
Yeah. So perhaps to take a little step back, what is actually innovative with Genius Act? Perhaps Genius Act makes a bigger step to recognize that you have a fully reserved token here or product here, whereas in the banking world, it's a fractional reserve product, right? Mm-hmm. And the question really under Genius was more how to actually minimize the risk that the stable coin is not stable. And so basically, they introduced one-to-one reserves like in Mika. But let's say you don't have such additional requirements, such as this extra capital requirement, or the composition of the reserves is not as rigid as under Mika. But if I want to, with a broad brush, basically you have under Genius liquid reserves, which are eligible for as reserve under Genius, and under Mika you have, and we are talking about mostly significant e-money tokens because the threshold is very low, and in Genius we have like a federal oversight from 10 billion onwards. So there you have liquid assets, whereas in Mika, if I compare to significant e-money tokens, you have high liquid assets, which again means that under Genius, it's mostly treasury bills, bonds, notes you have to hold, whereas under Mika, you have to hold bank deposits. And with the significant e-money tokens, 60% have to be held in bank deposits. So you are far away from buying treasury bills here, mostly. And they have to be held in a real bank, in a CRR financial institution. And you have this diversification criteria or requirement that they have to be held in different banks. And you don't have that under Genius. So basically, you have one-on-one redemption. You have these reserve requirements, which are liquid assets, but you don't have all these extra requirements as under Mika.
Yeah, I would also say Mika definitely more complex and also stricter when it comes to the reserve requirements, and stricter not in the sense that it gets more secure, it's just a bit more difficult to adhere to it. I would also say that in particular the requirement to hold at least 60% in bank deposits when you are a significant e-money token, that's quite tough. And this shows that apparently the European regulators are way more worried about liquidity risk, in the sense of if there is is a bank run on my stablecoin issuer, is the stablecoin issuer able to repay within a very short amount of time, which would of course be easier when you have it as bank deposits versus I first have to sell my treasury. But of course, what they are apparently less worried about is counterparty risk. And the Genius Act looks a bit more to counterparty risk because, of course, the US government is a better creditor than any bank, right? So it's more secure to hold a US treasury versus a deposit at any bank because it's more likely that a single bank fails versus the US to fail. So that's something it was always and still is difficult for me to wrap my head around, this 60% bank deposits for significant e-money token issuers, because I believe the best thing you can do is to invest it into very liquid European, let's say German government bonds, because it's very easy usually to get out of these bonds. It doesn't take you more than a couple of days. But yeah, that's definitely one difference.
Yeah, I mean, the Genius Act has innovation in its name, and that's basically the primary goal. And basically, you could say consumer protection, from a consumer protection perspective, it's great if you have the cash ready to redeem your consumer or the token holder. And also under a financial stability perspective, it's also better because if there's a bank run, there is liquidity.
But the problem is, what if there is a bank run on the bank that holds your deposits? I mean, we had that with Circle, right? So
yeah, exactly. So this is, I think, where Genius really breaks with the traditional system, that there's a deep mistrust of banks, and that basically the weak part in the system is seen in banks and not in the stablecoin issuer. It's about managing the risks of keeping the token stable. It is better not to use a bank if you refer to this Silicon Valley Bank, Silvergate banking crisis, because the bank collapsed, but the stablecoin issuers did not.
Yeah, probably a middle ground is a good thing, because I would also say to totally try to avoid banks is also not a good idea. Yeah, you also mentioned a second very important point. I want to emphasize that again, because from an issuer's perspective, that's a huge difference. Now, when I look at the business case for a stablecoin issuer, that you do not have to hold additional capital, meaning own funds, capital, no capital requirements for issuers under Genius. I mean, you have, if you're a bank, of course, you have your standard capital requirements, but there's nothing on top for the stablecoin business, while in Europe you have 2% as a non-significant EMT issuer, and then 3% or potentially even more if you're significant. And I mean, whoever has worked in detail through a business case for a stablecoin issuer, this can become a lot of money very quickly. So if you have a couple of billion in stablecoin outstanding and you have to hold 2 or 3% in own funds, it's hundreds of millions very quickly. And that's just money that sits on a bank account in the end, right? Which always hurts when you calculate a business case.
Exactly. And it also leads to our, let's say, concentration of bigger players. And that perhaps with the Genius Act, that you have like under 10 billion, the state-run system also leads to more diversification, or let's say fintech federalism, as it is called here in the US. And you have quite a big spectrum. I mean, Wyoming, the state of Wyoming has issued a stablecoin, but you also have like Circle in New York with BIT license and money transmitter license. And this kind of diversity actually is wanted, right?
You have already mentioned consumer protection. And one thing which is maybe not immediately obvious to everyone, but where it becomes clear that MiCA is actually putting a lot of weight on consumer protection, is when we look at the redemption. So under which circumstances can I redeem, and kind of how deeply ingrained is it into law that I have this right of redemption? Maybe you can quickly touch on that, how Genius and MiCA differ there when it comes to the right to redeem a stablecoin.
So basically, under Genius, you have a requirement to draft or to come up with a redemption policy, and that you have to disclose your fee schedule. But you do not have, like under MiCA, the obligation of the issuer to the holder of the token to redeem their token at any time. And so basically, it's more, let's say, much more industry friendly, that if I take the example of Circle again, I have not looked into their terms of service, and it's just as an example, that they basically sell or offer their stablecoin to big distributors like Coinbase, and then they redeem the stablecoin with the distributors, but not with the end user. users. And in under Mika, you have basically this assurance that you can at any time redeem the euro you gave for euro-backed stable at any time.
Yeah, I think this point in Mika is, in my opinion, often underappreciated, because I believe this is what actually makes e-money tokens, so European Mika-regulated stablecoins, actual money. I mean, it's e-money in the end, and it's very similar to a deposit where you also have to write to go there, right? A legally ingrained right to go there and redeem your deposit for cash in that case. And this is also why I'm always fighting hard for kind of just naming stablecoins euro, right? As much as we don't differentiate between euro cash and euro deposits and euro maybe central bank money reserves, it's all euros. Stablecoins should also simply be called euros in Europe, because it is actually euros, which might be different in other jurisdictions.
Yeah, no, it's a good point, because from a user perspective, I should not worry about different issuers, right? That's how cash works, that I just have a euro and I don't have to think about it, whether it's an Italian or German euro or who issued it. And if we have different redemption policies and redemption requirements, legal requirements, then I have to start to worry, and then I have to kind of look under the hood to what's actually happening.
But now you bring me actually to a point, and this goes a bit already into the direction of what's next for Europe now. How should Europe react? Because in the end, if it's of course true, there is an important difference between deposits or banks and EMT stablecoin issuers in Europe, which is they do not have direct access to central bank money, because you just said as an end user, you should not have to worry, to which I fully agree. But we're not there yet, right? Because if my bank goes bust, there is the central bank as a lender of last resort, while at least under Mika, as a stablecoin issuer, I do not have the central bank that backs me up. How is that under Genius Act?
Yeah, so under Genius Act, of course, you have just the reserve assets to back up the one-on-one redemption. And even banks, they don't come in as depository institutions. They are defined as such and to be eligible to issue stable coins, but they don't bring their insurance with them, because that's going into the weed in which cases you can actually apply federal insurance. So just to summarize, you have to know the end user, and that is not happening if you have the issuer basically offering the stable coins to a distributor, and then they're actually distributed to the end user. And that is a problem, and banks actually have to apply for an OCC or state license, a federal license or state license to issue stable coins, and that's a different system from the banking system, where you actually have the central bank as a creditor of last resort.
Okay, so also as a bank, if I in the US as a bank issue a stablecoin, the outstanding stablecoins are not FDIC insured. That's kind of segregated. And of course, I'm definitely not getting any segregated account at the central bank where I can put my reserve there that's segregated from everything else.
Talking about the segregation, yes. So again, we are in the stablecoin world. The bank actually applies most likely for a federal license, because the federal license actually is valid in all 50 states. And then, yes, there is a prohibition of commingling of funds. But let's say there are exceptions. And so the segregation requirement is not as strict again as under Mika, where you not only have to keep the funds segregated without exemption, but that you also have to have a third-party custodian to hold the assets and have to pay for it. And talking about business model again, that's more expensive than for convenience, hold customers' funds commingled with your other funds in an omnibus account.
One other interesting difference between Mika and Genius, and this maybe brings us already a bit into the discussion of how does the US in general and the approach of the US in general differ when it comes to stablecoins versus Europe, is how foreign stablecoin issuers or non-US stablecoin issuers and stablecoins are treated, and how easy it is to actually enter the US and become a stablecoin issuer versus entering the EU market and become a stablecoin issuer.
Yeah, so that was one of the, I already said that Democrats came on board for national security reasons to actually take care of the so-called Tether loophole that the biggest US stablecoin issuer actually is headquartered in El Salvador. And so the foreign payment stablecoin issuer provision made its way into the legislation in the House. And basically, the foreign payment stablecoin issuer has to register with the OCC. But there is this principle of international mutual recognition of different regimes. So basically, you don't have to apply for a license. You have to register. And then if there is a recognition of the license, the foreign license, you are in. I mean, there are some more conditions, but basically, that's the idea. And so the system is much more open to foreign issuers than MiCA, where you basically don't have such a provision, where you have to go through the whole application process and have to be established in the EU.
Yeah. So in the US, if I have a license as an EMT issuer under MiCA, I can, simplifying now a bit, go to the US, basically announce that I'm there to the regulator, and then I can basically start.
Yeah, you have to announce, and there is a registration process, and and the registration can be rejected, but it is deemed to be approved after 30 days if you don't reject. So there is, let's say, it's kind of built in that the regulator can opt out. It's not like an opt-in, so to say, right?
Yeah, so it seems to be that you realize that at different points, but that's one point where you realize the US is very open, say, everyone come to us, please come issue your stable coins. That's one point. And then a second point, and please correct me if I'm wrong here, they are also, they do not seem to be worried at all that non-US dollar stable coins are issued out of the US or kind of pushed into the US markets, because my impression is that's one of the main concerns of the ECB and the euro area or the European Union. So it seems like the US, and maybe that's actually, I would probably, as the issuer of the world reserve currency, take it a very similar stance. They seem to be like, we anyway are the biggest and best, so no one else can compete against the US dollar. So if you want, you can try. While Europe is very, oh my God, we have to do everything that no US dollar stablecoins come into the European Union.
Yeah. Yeah, so basically, the US already had this giant market dominance that basically internet money is in US dollars. So it was easy to actually use that to your strategic advantage and then basically create a framework to actually maintain this dominance, right? And so, no, they are not at all worried. that's perhaps this 99% US dollar stablecoin perspective. Come and register.
I liked it when you said in one of our earlier conversations over the last days that you could actually call what the US is doing a global passporting. So they allow everyone to come to the US and issue stablecoins very easily. While in the EU, that's definitely not the case. And of course, we have the EU passporting, where it's usually the case when you enter one EU country and get a license, you are allowed to enter the whole market in Europe. But you then told me that that's already been discussed at the moment, in particular when it comes to stablecoins.
Yeah. So basically, one word about this kind of open system or not. Let's say the US is not worried about non-US nominated stablecoins. You can see that you don't have these transaction caps like in the EU, right? So once you are in, your stables can freely circulate on the secondary market, which is not regulated by Genius. But in Clarity, you don't have these kind of transaction limitations. And yes, the passporting inside the EU is one of the big one of the big selling points next to regular certainty, and the scalability is very important, right? If you want to create a market through regulation. And so we have to take it seriously, and there should not be, let's say, any headlines about national competent authorities not trusting each other or like a second look of the European authorities. I mean, it is necessary that, MiCA is a regulation, so it's a harmonized approach. And we can see with MiFID that it is really problematic if you have a very fractionalized market. So there is a need to have like one regime and standard. But on the other hand, you should not kind of second guess decisions of national competent authorities in this from this competition perspective, right?
It's of course not a stablecoin, unique stablecoin issue, and to a certain extent, I understand the tier one regulators a bit at least, because when you look to BaFin or the French regulator, they of course are usually way more strict than, I don't want to name names, but everyone for sure has one or two names now in his or her head. I mean, it is, if I was BaFin now, I would probably think the same. They are definitely interpreting certain rules differently than BaFin does.
Yeah, I mean, if you compare again the two systems, now you have this dual system of federal license and state license in the US, and you have a big variety, right? If you want to have like a high quality license, you go to New York, right? The BIT license, it took a circle several years, 2015 to 23, to get the BIT license in New York. And then you have like the special depository trust company in Wyoming, which is a bit easier. That's what you can also call competition and a certain choice. And on the other hand, yeah, you have scalability in the US now too, because before you had to actually go to all 50 states to apply for a money transmitter license and a specific license for cryptocurrency activities. And now in the Clarity Act, you will have a preemption, which means that you have the federal regime. And if you, for example, then have an OCC license to issue stable coins, you can go anywhere. So you have this kind of scalability now in the US, which again should be something to be noticed in the EU, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's maybe move on, talk a bit about what does that mean now for Europe and how should Europe react? I mean, you've already made one point that passporting is important and we should definitely keep that a viable option for everyone because this makes the market extremely attractive. Is there anything else that has changed now for Europe or the EU, given that Genius is now out and Clarity is probably following?
Basically, we should worry in Europe, or let's say, make sure that we have market participants, right? So people who are, or let's say, entities who are in the market should stay. And I'm, again, for example, multi-issuers, right, who struggle to basically juggle or kind of get on one page with different redemption and reserve requirements, issuing multiple coins. They struggle to keep up with the European legislation.
So maybe just to clarify that point, so when you say multi-issuer, you mean someone, for instance, like Circle, right? They are issuing a US dollar stablecoin in the US, of course. They are issuing a US dollar stablecoin also in Europe under MiCA, and they are issuing a euro stablecoin in Europe under MiCA. And the, what do you say, when redemption and custody, or in particular redemption or reserve requirements differ, is of course MiCA, as we have discussed, has slightly different reserve requirements than what's in the US. But my understanding is of MiCA that you are actually globally, you have the right to redeem, right? Which means that somehow European players or regulators have to deal with requirements that happen in other jurisdictions, which of course is maybe less an issue with Genius, because that's at least at a high level similar. But what if others, maybe less a tier one jurisdiction, start with stablecoin regimes, and then you have to go to that country and can redeem a stablecoin against totally different assets versus what's actually happening in Europe?
Yeah, so to unpack that, so first of all, from the perspective of a secondary market, that's not the topic of today because we talk about the issue, but the secondary market players, exchanges, they basically have to kind of keep track with the circulation on the secondary market. And it is really difficult if the coin is circulating globally, right? And you have to also kind of back it, as you say, you have to back up the redemption claim with reserves. And then as a significant e-money token issuer, you have to have reserve assets for each specific coin. And depending on where it is issued, you have to kind of keep the reserves basically par. And so you have this kind of rebalancing problem. And these are basically compliance issues which should be taken seriously if we want to keep these players here, I would say. And otherwise, there is a discussion of MiCA 2. Let's say a lot of criticism has been around the high quota of cash, like 60% cash of your reserve assets as a significant stablecoin issuer. Perhaps there could be a discussion what to do about this, let's say, you know, like to provide liquidity. And if we take the user perspective again, that you want to trust the euro denominated stablecoins, what could we do about that? That we ensure that you can actually establish a viable, sustainable business model and on the other hand, keep the user, the consumer protected.
My impression is also that Mika has become, I mean, you had that level one text, right? That high, let's say relatively high level was already a couple of hundred pages, but still high level level one text, which was, I would say, still strikes a good balance between consumer protection, financial stability, but also allowing for innovation. And then since then, we have all these technical standards, regulatory technical standards, implementation standards. And my impression is that it since then has become more and more complex, of course, but also less and less supportive for innovative business models. What's your impression on the kind of the development from level one to level two, level three?
To be fair, Genius was just passed and there is a lot of authorization of rulemaking, right?
We are not yet even at level one, or maybe level 0.7 or so.
Yeah, exactly. So there will be rules coming and we will see. Right. But on the other hand, yes, I would say that, yeah, Mika was striking a balance. And now I think we have, let's say, the financial stability argument. I hear a lot. I hear a lot of talking about risk and less about opportunities. And now we have the financial sovereignty argument coming on top of it. And yes, I would also say that the compliance burden is, yeah, pretty heavy, but let's see what is coming in the US. But right now, it is not comparable, I would say. Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned now this focus in Europe that's more on risk than opportunities. That's, in my opinion, or that's one of my biggest concerns, actually, because when I compare the sentiment in the US versus in Europe, we have in Europe a situation where actually the communication around stablecoins is and the debates are very much focused on the concerns. And I think one reason for that is that in particular the European Central Bank, but also the Bank for International Settlements, have, of course, and that's good, a very strong voice when it comes to the money in general, but also the regulation of money. And they are unfortunately very, let's say, I wouldn't say totally anti-stable coins, but they are very much focused on risks. And of course, with the ECB, that's one reason might be that they have their own digital euro, which they present as a solution to US dollar stable coins. But it has to be clear that the digital euro, and also Piero Cipollone said that a couple of days ago, we don't have the necessary legislation yet to issue a digital euro from the ECB in Europe. As soon as we have this, he said it will be another 2 to 3 years until the digital euro, the retail CBDC, goes live. So we're probably talking about 2029, if not 2030. And this, in my opinion, must not be the European answer to US dollar stablecoins, right? I think we need more support for euro stablecoins as well. And there are different things that in particular the ECB could do in order to support euro stablecoins and then also to really make a difference between US dollar and euro stablecoins. And let me just make this one point, because we discussed about it before. For instance, what the ECB could do is it could start playing a similar role for euro stablecoins and euro stablecoin issuer as it does for banks already today, namely becoming something like a lender of last resort and providing liquidity to stablecoin issuers in the scenario of a bank run, which simply means I'm lending money as a central bank against high quality collateral to stablecoin issuers. That should be an absolute no-brainer, in my opinion, because the balance sheet of stablecoin issuers in Europe are packed with high quality liquid assets and good collateral. So there might be liquidity issues, but in very rare cases, there will be any solvency issues. So the central bank acting as this lender of last resort against good collateral would increase customer protection. It would improve financial stability. And I think these are the discussions we should have instead of only talking about the digital euro CBDC being the solution.
Yeah. So as we already said, that would basically lift this burden to have like 60% cash and to have this own funds up to 3% and would basically free capital. And you have, of course, in the US, again, I named Circle. They are applying for a national trust company license, meaning they will be able to offer custody services. First of all, they can actually hold their own stablecoin reserves, but they also can offer to third parties custody services like tokenized assets, for example. And so, of course, that's a totally different business model than we have in Europe. The only thing is, of course, once you start, like it's a comprehensive system. Once you start changing things, of course, we should not forget that you have this kind of global redemption obligation of European issuers, right? Which might be a problem. But generally, I think to rethink what we want with stablecoins to actually minimize the risk concerning the stability of this token and not overplay perhaps the contagion risk and basically treat stablecoins like bank deposits, right? Because they are already collateralized. And again, in the US, we would say it's not fractional reserves and you're not allowed to lend, right, as an issuer. So liquidity has a totally different role in the stablecoin world, actually, than in the bank deposit world of banks, right?
Yeah. I agree. I think there are a lot of interesting discussions, and I say this now as a monetary economist by training at least, there are a lot of interesting discussions to be had about what stablecoins means for monetary policy and money overall, because I hear a lot of discussions about, oh, but then stablecoin issuers create money, which then sounds a bit like fractional reserve banking, which is not true. I have also heard Piero Cipollone say, he was in the European Parliament, where he said that then the seniorage revenue ends up with stablecoin issuers, which is also something I disagree with, because goes a bit too much into detail now to open up that topic. But this just shows that there is a lot to learn about stablecoins and a lot of interesting discussions to be had when it comes to the monetary policy implications of this new form of money, you have to say.
Yeah, and I think I find it always fascinating to compare the different systems, because from an outside perspective, you can basically look at your own system in a different way. And at the end of the day, also from the user perspective, again, to use this global technology, which enables cheaper and faster cross-border payments, right? It would be necessary that we have, let's say, more of a mutual understanding and agreement and should not deviate too much from each other, right? In terms of what we are dealing with, right?
Yeah. Anya, these have already been nice last words. I will nevertheless would like to give you the chance to add anything that we might have forgotten today, any points about Mika, Genius, or the difference between those two US versus EU approaches to stablecoins you might want to add.
You have let me talk quite a lot. Perhaps I say something about Clarity. So Genius and Clarity are not two completely separate animals, so to say. Clarity will regulate secondary market transactions in payment stablecoins, and the payment stablecoin world will depend on the market structure which is coming. And the Clarity Act will have amendments, which is perhaps also kind of interesting to take a quick look. So the interesting is, again, the reserve management, and that has been a big point of discussion among us. And there you only have a monthly reporting on the reserve composition. If you stay under 10 billion US dollars above, you have a financial statement or financial audit, a yearly audit. But there will be now like an external monitoring obligation obligation through an accounting firm. And this kind of points to perhaps a discussion about the conflict of interest. And there will be a commodity-backed stablecoin coming. We only have now talked about the fiat currency-backed stablecoins like dollar, euro, like the EMT. But there will be something coming which resembles more ART. And we should prepare for that. And the right to self-custody will be enshrined in the Genius Act. I mean, the Senate has to still approve this and it has to go through the whole process. But with this strong bipartisan support from the House, this might very much be reality soon.
Okay, very interesting. So thanks for that outlook. So it's worth following the Clarity Act, not only if you're interested in market infrastructure overall, which is, of course, the focus of Clarity, but also if you are interested in stablecoins, because it will have an effect on Genius. Anya, thanks a lot for being our guest today. Thanks a lot that I was allowed to borrow your brain for that podcast, but also for the article, which I'm going to link, as said, in the show notes. It was a lot of fun. I learned a lot in particular. So thanks for being on. Thanks also, dear listeners, for tuning in again. Please don't forget to like and subscribe, leave a comment, and then until next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much, everyone. A complex topic, and we even made it even more complex. So thank you for your attention.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.